This is an ABC podcast.
With all the headlines this week, that famous Donald Trump phrase, China, 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 keeps rattling around in my head.
Yes, and this big visit by the Foreign Minister Wang Yi has certainly prompted us to ask, what is really going on inside China?
The black box of Chinese politics is so hard to crack into, but some reckon Xi Jinping might actually be in some trouble.
And if China's economic miracle is over, what does that mean for us?
I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
This is Global Roaming. Hey, Jerry.
Hello there.
How are you going?
Good, good.
In terms of the Australia-China relationship, this week really has been a very big week.
Yes, it has. I mean, that Wang Yi, he's a big cheese coming here, and it did feel like there was, there was a little bit of a new era coming. It is an annual dialogue. It's become an annual dialogue.
And kind of weird to be calling it a new era because actually he finished up as foreign minister. There was a new foreign minister, and then suddenly that foreign minister disappeared and Wang Yi is back. So that in itself tells us something about what is going on inside China, which we will get to later in this episode.
Yeah, look, we will. I mean, I do think that we have probably moved to as well. I just think we're a little less panicky about China.
Chinese foreign minister?
I know, but that's people get themselves, good dear me, they do get themselves hysterical. I mean, I just think we've got to calm down. We've got to be much more poised when these big people visit us. You know, that's what mature countries do. Just calm down and don't overreact.
But isn't there a version of this, which is us seeing a bit of hypocrisy in the way China is operating? Because on the one hand, China is clearly making an effort to be more amiable in its dealings with us, dropping some of the tariffs, etc., sending a big diplomat to visit Penny Wong. Yet for all of that, they're going to visit the one former prime minister that has personally targeted Penny Wong, who has spoken, you know, in very strong terms about AUKUS. I mean, they've chosen the one person that's really going to irritate, aren't they?
No, I don't see it like that. No, I just think, look, if Bob Hawke were alive, they'd see him. They both did enormous amounts of business in China. I just think this idea that they can't speak to other sort of luminaries, you know, the Chinese favour age. They've got a great respect for age.
I'm not disagreeing with any of that. I just think sometimes, you know, China plays a very shrewd game
It's a great power. Great powers play games. That's what great powers do, you know, and they always have and they always will. And that's what we've got to come to terms with and not get hysterical about. In my opinion. Not that I really care.
I didn't realise you were so wound up about this.
I wish we could be a little more relaxed about the fact that we do matter now quite a lot more than we did. We're in the region where an enormous amount is happening and will continue to happen. And if we are to wield more influence, we'll have to practice being a little more poised. And so will a lot of the media, by the way.
Australia and sort of diplomacy and poise doesn't really come to mind when you...
We better learn it.
But look at the way we reacted this week when Trump made those little offhand comments about Kevin Rudd.
You know, I can't... You know what I think about... I'm not going to waste too much... Look, you know, Kevin will survive one way or the other.
He's a robust character, isn't he, our former Prime Minister?
But look, there is lots happening inside China. I mean, I think that the sort of really important point about why we chose to do the episode this week, not just because people were visiting, is that there's so much cross-current of commentary about what is happening in China. A lot of people say, you know, you can't put any money in China anymore at the moment. It would be unsafe to advise anybody to do so. Where are they? It's not clear cut, but they certainly may not be making that inexorable rise that they were before.
Yeah, so I guess for the course of the last few decades, China has appeared to be unstoppable. The economic rise has been phenomenal. We've all observed that, but there's also been, you know, increasing diplomatic footprint on the world stage. China's thrown its might around economically, certainly in our region, but also the military rise and this huge military buildup that is underway, which does, somewhat, I suppose, set the tone for the geopolitics.
Well, it should certainly be something we take great notice of. They're still building more nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers than anybody else. So you can't take your eyes off that. But it's just that there might be a different context emerging within China in terms of their own growth rate and, of course, what iron ore they need from us than they have in the past, say, 10 to 20 years.
And there's one particular thing that I think we both observed in recent weeks, which stood out as an example of, oh, hang on, what's actually going on there? And that was when, you know, they have these plenary sessions that their so-called parliament meets in China once a year. And generally what happens afterwards is they do this big press conference. Right, with the premier, they front up. I mean, it's pretty stage managed. The questions are selected and all the rest of it, but it is a press conference. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, they said, "We're not doing that. We're not doing it at all this year.
Not till 2026." It was that caveat. We won't have one till 2026. For me, that was a really extraordinary sort of little tangible sign that something is shifting.
So lots to discuss, and we're both, I think, pumped. Is that the right word about the person we're talking to this week? Do you want to introduce Rana Mitter?
Yes, Professor Rana Mitter is, I think, probably the best respected commentator on modern China. He made his very glittering name at Oxford University. His latest book is China's Good War, How World War II is Shaping a New Nationalism. He's just moved to Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And just as an aside, he supervised Kevin Rudd's PhD thesis on China, so we just might get to that as well. But it's a great pleasure to have him join us. Rana Mitter, welcome to Global Roaming.
Geraldine, it's a great pleasure to be there with you and Hamish.
Are we seeing, in your view, peak China? In other words, a China that has experienced this phenomenal rise, but possibly has come to the top of that rise. Is it peak China? Is it plateau China? Now, what's your view? Because there are very conflicting views on this.
I think, Geraldine, if I may say so, that the shape of the peak is changing, by which I mean this. I think the model that China has managed to use very successfully in some ways for the last 30, 40 years, in other words, growing its economy, becoming the second biggest GDP in the world on a mixture of things, including a very, very healthy export capacity, developing new technologies, and also, of course, having a booming property sector at home. All of these, together with spending on infrastructure after the financial crisis, you know, building up the railways, building up the roads, they provided a really long period of development in terms of China's economy. But I think that moment has really come to a fairly clear halt at the moment. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is actually demographic. China famously had a one-child policy for nearly 40 years. And although that ended about 7 or 8 years ago, and now you can basically have multiple children if you want to, it had the effect of creating a real slowing down, and then ultimately, probably in a few years' time, reversing of the growth of the population. In other words, over the next few decades, China will begin to slowly but surely shrink in population size. And that means, for instance, fewer young families who need those apartments that are being built as part of the building boom. It also means that the children that there are finding that as the economy slows down, the economic opportunities that they thought they would have, maybe for those high-value jobs in tech or in services or in finance, well, they're just not available in the way that they were 5 or 6 years ago. So I'd say that it's not that China is down and out. It does have fantastic technological capability to innovate. It has a very, very strong export sector. It's very well embedded in the wider world. And the second biggest economy in the world is not nothing. But I think that it cannot continue in the shape that it's doing now. So China may yet peak, but it'll peak in a different way from what we would have thought just a few years ago.
The Communist Party, though, has reinforced its own power over time by continuing to offer people economic growth and prosperity. This flattening, if we want to describe it that way, what does that mean for its grip on power? Does Xi Jinping have to worry about this now?
Well, Hamish, I think that although I do not, I should make it clear to ABC podcast listeners, have any kind of direct insight into the mind of Xi Jinping. I think very few people have it. That would be a real
exclusive. Oh, come on, Rana. That's why we got you on.
Well, I'm going to take a guess at this anyway. And of course, he's welcome to write in or get in touch on social media if he disagrees. I think that Xi Jinping and the people around him think a lot about what I sometimes call China's median voter. And that's probably an inaccurate term because, as I'm sure will be no surprise to anyone listening in, China doesn't actually have elections. But what it does have is a growing middle class about which the party is very, very concerned. So let's take a young woman. Let's call her Zhang Xiaodan, you know, sort of typical Chinese name, made up person. She lives in a third or fourth level city in China, not kind of gleaming skyscrapers of Shanghai, maybe somewhere like Ningbo down in the kind of east central side. She works in financial services, but her own salary is a little bit precarious. She's spending a lot of it on mortgage payments, which is actually a huge deal in China because a lot of property has been very expensive. Let's make her a single mother. That's not so usual in China, but it's becoming much more common than it used to be. And she's got one child who she really wants to make sure gets educated and gets a good job. But education is very expensive in China. You have to pay for extra tutoring and all sorts of other fees as well. So that person is looking at the CCP, looking at the Chinese Communist Party and saying, well, guys, what have you done for me lately? In other words, is there going to be a proper infrastructure for me to bring up my child? Because I'm not going to have two or three children unless I know that I can actually afford to bring them up. Are there going to be good jobs? Is the technology which you boast about so much actually going to change the labor market and create new ways for me to be able to make a living? And I think that is something that Xi Jinping and others are really worried about. The reason that we can say that they're worried is that actually Xi Jinping did something very unusual at the beginning of the year, the calendar year, the New Year message that he put out on Chinese television and broadcast. And in that message, which was mostly a pretty triumphalist story of how China was doing well on all fronts, he did add a very sort of brief apology, or, you know, a near apology, in which he said, look, I know that a lot of people are finding it very difficult at the moment to make a living. Now, it's almost unprecedented for top Chinese leaders, certainly in that kind of New Year greeting, to say, actually, I know that not everything is going well. And I think that's a sign that people must have been coming to him in the Politburo, in the top leadership, and saying, you know, despite the fact that we're telling this very glorious story, actually, a lot of people out there for whom this isn't the reality.
And Rana, that is very interesting. That I wonder if COVID played a role here too, because almost a long COVID effect, you know, or a hangover. Those huge demonstrations that they had in a range of cities over the continued lockdowns seemed to spook them. And then they turned on a dime and changed all their rules. And possibly, you know, some of the estimates are there are 1 million people died as a result because they really were not prepared. Now, in your judgment, does all of this aftermath of COVID play a role in that disenchantment that you're hinting at?
Geraldine, it is hugely important. I think that anyone you talk to who analyzes the way in which public mood has changed in China in the last, I don't know, let's say 1.5 years, something like that, will pinpoint COVID and the way in which the authorities dealt with COVID. And Xi Jinping's personal policy was very much about ultra lockdown, and if any case of COVID is found, then there's people immediately have to get, you know, taken off into quarantine. It was a very, very uncompromising policy, and it was very much tied to him personally. And this created huge resentment. I mean, of course, COVID itself, as you say, is no longer a direct issue in China, not least because the policy was reversed so quickly. But I think there is a sense in which it has, in some ways, created a skepticism about whether or not the Chinese Communist Party's story, its narrative about stay within China's borders and you'll be safe. You know, our job here is to basically keep you safe from the dangerous outside world full of nasty liberal influences. And in many cases, I think the COVID experience is leaving people to say, well, is that necessarily actually going to be the case? But you talked about the protests. If you want a prediction, and getting one from here, as to where the next protests might come from, I would look at one of the areas that is perhaps not the most glamorous, but one of the most important in China, as in the rest of the world. That is pensions. Because essentially of that demographic crisis I mentioned, and because of basically not putting enough into the system, China's pension system, according not to me and not according to some, you know, dissident who's trying to spread trouble, but according to the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, which is one of the most respectable institutions in the country, the system is going to be bankrupt by the mid-2030s unless a lot more money is put in, and also the retirement ages are raised from 60 for men, 55 for women. I would say that when that happens, and I think it's inevitable that the raising of ages will happen quite soon, that a lot of older people in China who have worked hard for their pensions and through no fault of their own are being told, actually, you're going to have to wait longer to get it. That's the kind of thing that could also people very angry, because it directly impacts on their lives in a way that, you know, democracy or abstract political ideas often don't.
Went so well for Macron in France.
I was about to say, I was thinking of the French, but if you see the French demonstrating in the streets, you just wait till you see Shanghai.
So what does this mean for Xi Jinping as the boss? Because from the outside, I guess we perceive him as being almost untouchable, that he's so firm in his grip on power. Is he?
So it's interesting you call him the boss there, Hamish, because actually if you talk to a lot of Chinese people in China, they will very rarely use his name. They won't say, Comrade Xi or Chairman Xi. They'll call him Lao Da, which means literally the boss. You know, it's a kind of way of referring to him. And I would say that in terms of the elite level of Chinese politics, in other words, the Standing Committee, the Politburo, the top seven in the leadership, and then the Politburo of several hundred, which surrounds that, getting inside that black box is very difficult indeed. Certainly kind of humble scholars like me don't get anywhere near it. Mm. What we tend to find is that when something explosive happens, we can then extrapolate from that. So the examples I'd give would be the recent dismissals, firings, really, more active than just a dismissal of the foreign minister, Qin Gang, a few months ago, the defense minister, Li Shangfu. There are various other people, including military figures, who've been got rid of quite recently. And so we see that. That's an observable phenomenon, you might say. And you can then extrapolate from that, well, various things must have happened, and what can we say? What we can say is still quite limited, but I think the following things are probably fair to say. Xi Jinping himself does still seem to be entirely dominant. I think in terms of domestic politics, it's hard at the moment to see a reasonable scenario in which a policy change really imperils Xi Jinping, or they should never say never. With foreign policy, I think it is different. I think that one of the reasons that we've had a real stepping back from very confrontational rhetoric from China. In fact, very much the reverse. I mean, as you said, Minister Wang Yi has been recently in Australia, met Penny Wong, I believe, met former Prime Minister Paul Keating as well. And the holding out of the hand to Australia, a country with which China has had a pretty terrible relationship in recent years. The attempt to woo the Europeans, a quick example, they've just announced in the last few weeks that Germany and Italy are getting visa-free access to China, which is a big sort of bonus. They're certainly not giving that to the Americans. All of that, I think, is a recognition on the part of the leadership, and she would certainly be part of that, that unless the domestic economy is stabilized, then anything from trying to, quote, resolve the Taiwan situation to the perhaps more workaday issues of trying to create a regional order in Asia to compete with the United States is going to be very hard to do. So I think we are seeing maybe not so much Xi being opposed, but Xi being forced, in a sense, by global circumstances to take a policy that is maybe less risk-taking, maybe even less confrontational than his temperament might like.
So for a country like Australia, who's just so inextricably involved in trying to read these tea leaves from outside, as you're saying, do we assume from what you're saying that there is going to be a more benign interaction over the next little while? And will that be both overt and covert? Because there's great concern here, often expressed, sometimes overexpressed, about real subterfuge by China of our democratic systems and so on. Now, I mean, what's your reading of how they're likely to interact with a country like us?
I think that the overall aim of Chinese foreign policy has not changed particularly, but the tactics have. And the overall aim, in a sense, it's the aim of any country, but I think China's particularly dogged in its pursuit of this, is to adjust regional and global order as much as possible to make sure that China's interests are safeguarded as much as possible. And part of that is essentially a sort of tactic to try and make sure that other actors, other countries, are as dependent on China as possible, while China is as little dependent on them the other way around. Now, China is not in a position wholly to be able to reverse the emphasis so that it is basically in control of economic resources or trade routes or whatever it might be, and Australia or other countries hold none of the cards at all. But I think certainly the feeling at the moment that it is more useful for China to be able to persuade other actors that are not the United States in the world that China might have something to offer is a very strong one at the moment. It sees that the world is currently in an economically dangerous moment as well as a geopolitically dangerous moment. And China itself, as we've been saying over and over, has been going through a very difficult economic period. For that reason, making sure that it has access to Australia's markets becomes more important than it might have been at a time when China was riding high. It's also the case that China would like to make sure that the regional organizations in which it takes a leadership role get more strength as the American contribution seems more patchy. And while that's going on, Australia will have a lot of, you know, boyfriends or girlfriends, depending which way you want to go, to talk to, who like to come speak sweet words. But their intention is very much not just your pretty faces, but your wallet as well.
Just on the direct relationship, though, that a country like Australia has with China, I mean, it does seem that the bellicose rhetoric of the wolf warrior diplomacy has been done away with, at least for now. And yet at the same time, many of the features of the challenging parts of the relationship remain. And so you get the kind of hawks in a country like Australia saying, look, well, they're continuing to do this, they're continuing to undermine democracy, they're continuing to operate, you know, in ways that challenge international norms in the region. And then you get the more dovish thinkers in Australia saying, well, look, you know, actually, they do want to be on better terms. And here are all the things they're doing. They're sending the foreign minister to visit us. They're dropping some of the trade sanctions. Can you help us understand how those two things might both be right?
Well, they are both right, I think, Hamish. I think that's correct. Let me give you a specific example, which I think makes the case quite nicely, and that's AUKUS. This has been a controversial agreement, but one of the reasons that China has been able to kind of press the buttons in Australia on the controversy is that Australian politicians are not united on whether or not it's a good idea. There are at least two prominent prime ministers of both parties, ex-prime ministers, I should say, Malcolm Turnbull, and also recently, I think, Paul Keating, who have been pretty vocal in saying...
It's a live debate, Rana.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was about to say, you know, the world is keeping an eye on Australia on these things too. My point being that this is a debate going on within Australian politics. You know, it's not for me to tell the Australian people what to do, and I wouldn't dream of doing that. But China is certainly very practiced at seeing where there are domestic issues that relate to foreign policy and then putting forward its own view about which way that should go. In the case of AUKUS, it's very simple. They do not want the AUKUS agreement to be implemented. And if they can find ways to essentially argue that greater trade relations or a kind of calmer and more integrated Indo-Pacific would be aided by ending the AUKUS program, then they will make that case.
So in that context, what do you make of the fact that when Wang Yi visited Australia, he met with the former Prime Minister, Paul Keating? Some say this is totally normal. It's very standard for former prime ministers to meet with visiting diplomats. Others say it's almost traitorous.
I think that it's actually fairly mainstream in a sense for, I mean, I think people are incensed because it's the Chinese. I mean, clearly, you know, if an American president came and wanted to meet an ex-prime minister of Australia, meet, you know, Tony Abbott or someone, I don't think they were saying, my God, he's talking to the Americans. So it is, I think, a question of China's status as a competitor that is bringing this to mind. I give you the example. I mean, I just put it forward because it's one of the most famous ones of the late Henry Kissinger, who passed away just a few months ago at the age of 100. And it was very clear that he visited China and talked to the Chinese, and the Chinese talked to him and visited him on a very regular basis. Now, you know, Kissinger's contribution in terms of the US-China relationship was controversial in some ways. Not everyone thought he was necessarily following the right path. And even some of his fellow Republicans, such as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in a quite polite way, were fairly critical of the relationship that he had built up. But I don't remember anyone very much saying, at least, you know, very prominently, that it's outrageous that the Chinese should talk to Henry Kissinger in the first place, or vice versa. And in that sense, I think you can say, if there is a dialogue to be had, and it's being had in an open, liberal and robust society, and, you know, Australian debate is nothing if not robust, and we like it that way, then a prime minister who can frankly stand up for himself. I mean, in the UK, where I'm quite often based, we still have many fond memories of Paul Keating as a user of extremely robust parliamentary language, some of which I think was passed on to British comrades and friends. Someone like that can stand up for himself. Someone like that is perfectly capable of telling Wang Yi what he thinks and what he doesn't think at any point. And if Wang Yi wants to talk to him, then it seems to me that it's another means of keeping dialogue open. I think the one thing you can say is that it'd be very difficult for a former prime minister of either party, either Liberal or Labour, to have conversations with senior Chinese without it being public. If there were secret conversations going on dubious things, I think that would be much more problematic. But public conversations? Really? I mean, come on, I think Australia can cope with that.
Look, just maybe to end with your impressions, because you've watched this place for so long, Do we have a different China emerging? Some people think we absolutely do. Profound changes occurring in attitudes towards individualism and the nation and so on among the young Chinese. Now, I just wonder what your impressions are of that tone within China.
I think you put your finger on something that is very, very visible. And you can see it if you look, for instance, on Chinese social media in terms of the way that young people talk about themselves and their lives. 5 or 6 years ago, even, perhaps just before the pandemic, I think there was this very triumphalist sense that, you know, China is rising, the West is declining, and everyone better get out of the way. And, you know, Xi Jinping and others at the top do still use a lot of that language when they want to speak in public. But I think that China's educated youth in particular, young men, young women, are finding that that story is not working for them anymore. And COVID has something to do with it, but it also links to issues such as youth unemployment and also underemployment. In other words, people who can find jobs, but, you know, they work night and day and spend a lot of family money to get a degree, for instance, and then find that they're working for a food delivery company. Now, that's not just a story in China. Lots of countries have underemployment in that sense, but it's new in the Chinese context. And it means that many young Chinese who thought that they were being trained to essentially be at the vanguard of a brave new world find the opportunities for them are far fewer than there were. In the midst of that, you know, that kind of social earthquake, Geraldine, I would point out particularly the changing position of young women in China, half the population, of course. And for a long time, it was often assumed, certainly by the party, that essentially the party as a whole, which is a very masculine sort of place, would speak for women's interests. But now there are far more women entrepreneurs than there were a generation ago, young women students who, of course, are graduating and wanting jobs as well. A lot of them are the people who are actually saying that the state and the party is not giving them the social bargain they want to actually get married, have kids, which the state is desperate for them to do because of the population decline. And instead, this turn towards a much more strongly feminist view that actually they'll make their own lives. That's a change that you can really see coming. The party doesn't like it at all. And you see lots of propaganda saying, it's very conservative in many ways. The party saying that, you know, it's very important for women to get married and have families and children and so forth. But what China's youth are actually doing in many cases is going, you know, men and women, is going on a rather different path that isn't necessarily simply what the party tells them to do. And that's in part because they're not convinced that the social and economic opportunities, which seemed so glittering just a few years ago, they're not gone. You know, they're not. There's no collapse on the horizon, I would say. But certainly what the great American journalist Evan Osnos has called the age of malaise seems to have touched China a bit more, particularly amongst its youth. And yeah, I think that is making a difference.
Aranamita, you supervised Kevin Rudd's doctoral thesis at Oxford, and of course he's very much been in the news with a commentary from Donald Trump. Knowing him as you do, what do you make of those comments?
Well, Kevin was indeed a student for his doctorate at Oxford, and I had the privilege of working with him there. But he, of course, has now become an immensely important public figure again as Australia's ambassador to the United States. I did see those comments from Donald Trump. And again, you know, it's up to the people in the public arena to engage with each other in the way that they want to do. What I'd say is that it's worth stepping back for a moment and realizing quite what a fortunate combination of talents in today's geopolitical world comes from having Kevin Rudd as ambassador in the US at the moment, as well as being someone, obviously, who has tremendous experience in statecraft because of his prime ministership. His ability to understand the Chinese system because of his very strong intellectual and academic knowledge of the system. And, you know, having read through, I think I can say he's read through an awful lot of Chinese political writings and understands it very well. And is able to talk to the Chinese in terms which they will understand and be able to engage with, even if quite often they disagree violently with him. Having someone with that skill set is a very, very rare thing. And I think that whoever is president of the United States in a few months' time, Joe Biden reelected or Donald Trump coming into power, is going to find that they need more people who have that level of experience around. So my strong suspicion is actually that if Donald Trump is president, then having a figure like Kevin Rudd around in Washington might be actually a huge asset from his point of view, and he might want to think about how best to use that asset.
Would Australia be better served with someone like Kevin Rudd representing us in Beijing rather than Washington, in your view?
I have to say that if you can get Mr. Albanese on the phone and he wants to get my advice on diplomatic appointments, I'd be more than happy to do that for him. All I could say is that all Western countries are going to need more and more people who speak Mandarin and who have an in-depth understanding of the Chinese system and what it is. So I think rather than trying to, you know, move around the one public figure in the West who really does have this very, very close understanding linguistically and intellectually of China. Develop more of them. Let's have more prime ministers, foreign ministers, and others who actually really understand China. Australia is one of the places that actually does do a good job at places like the Australian National University of training people in Mandarin. But the Western world is not doing enough to invest in the next generation of people who are going to have to deal with China from the Western side. And that's the message I think I'd take in terms of who needs to be going to Beijing, Shanghai, and other parts of the Chinese-speaking world where we're going to need to have dialogue for a long time to come.
Well, now, look, we've come to the point there's so much more we could discuss, but we'll leave it for another day, where we'd seek your recommendations, please, of what to read, listen to, or watch you think helps us understand this more.
Absolutely, Geraldine. Well, could I give you one with an Australian flavour to it, actually,
if I
may? So it's a new podcast, and it is co-hosted by a great Australian journalist who mainly has worked in American China, and that's Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief of the New York Times. And she is co-hosting it with me, in fact, actually. It's called Face Off. America versus China. And it's basically an exploration in 8 episodes through interviews of everyone from people involved with major technology companies to the great cellist Yo-Yo Ma is actually one of the interviewees as well on the culture side, to try and understand where the US-China relationship is going and whether it's going to remain stable or not. But I've had a blast making it with Jane. She's a fantastic reporter and knows China like the back of her hand. And I very much hope that, you know, the listeners will want to download that, available from the beginning of April, wherever you get your podcasts, and learn more about the US-China relationship as well.
What a terrific plug.
We can cope with a competitor.
Not a competitor. Let's just say a friend in the other corner. Indeed, addition.
Exactly. Right, admit it.
After we've listened to this one. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
it's been a
Ryan.
Pleasure, Hamish. Pleasure, Geraldine.
Well, Geraldine, Kevin Rudd reckons Rana Mitter is the rock star of contemporary China scholars, and he certainly performed. What did you think?
I thought he was his usual overview specialist, and I think he can go big and small, which is what I've always appreciated about him. And he's nuanced. He doesn't dodge things. I mean, that pension discussion was absolutely fascinating. I'd never heard anybody say that before. I love following China. And I think that is a very interesting observation, particularly about the rising middle class. Because, you know, you've got these sort of elites in China, then you've got the middle class, then you've got that we didn't even get to the rural area in this conversation because it's such a huge story. But that middle class, if they start to be restive, shall we say, seriously restive, well, the Communist Party knows it's in some real bother.
The conversation leaves me wrestling with those two versions of the way in which China's trying to project its power, which he spoke to so eloquently. And I suppose where I go to is, yes, Wang Yi does come to Australia and, you know, China does perhaps drop some of the trade sanctions. Perhaps there will be more positive signs there. Perhaps there is a more benign way in which China is projecting itself. But at the same time, a death sentence for Yang Hengjun, the Australian scholar in China, further security crackdowns in Hong Kong, you know, the total erosion really of the version of Hong Kong that existed. There's still so many things that China is doing which speak to that more slightly more aggressive version of where it sees itself on the world stage. And so I'm still trying to understand it, I think, myself.
Yeah, it's a wrestling match. It's very hard to discern. You can't come to lovely points of conclusion and say, right, we've got it now. I just don't think it conforms to that. And, like, why should it? It's too massive, you know, this... their massive regaining of dignity, as they see it, after 2 centuries of humiliation, and then what they do with that. And maybe they've arrived at that point where they can rest a bit. Who knows? I mean, we're trying to discern what it means. So I do think he sort of helped us develop a more broad view of what our interests are going forward. I hate that's a bit of a cliche, but... I feel I'm considerably better informed about it, and I think there's a lot more to come, and I think we'll see a lot more big visits like Wang Yi's visit.
Well, the suggestion is that this paves the way for the Chinese premier to make a visit, possibly in the middle of the year. So, we'll wait for those headlines.
Yes, we will indeed. And look, I think watch that space, to quote other cliches.
Well, Jerry, it's time for recommendations. What are you suggesting this week?
I began watching something called Turning Point, The Bomb and the Cold War. It's a Netflix documentary. Now, I've only watched one episode. It's quite a commitment. I think there are about 11 or something. It's beautifully made. And it very much puts, well, they say, if you don't understand the Cold War, you don't understand Putin, for instance. It's a context for where we are now. And in fact, the whole discussion we've just had with Rana Mitter. So look, I do commend it to people. It's quite something. It's on Netflix.
I'm recommending Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. Now, this is written by the historian Arne Westad. He previously held the academic chair that Rana Mitter now holds at Harvard's Kennedy School. It's, I think, a brilliant explanation of China's dynastic history and its connection with the way China projects its foreign policy today. I took his course for a semester at the Kennedy School. Absolutely phenomenal mind. The book is very digestible, even though the topics and the themes are pretty complex. It's called Restless Empire. Highly recommend it.
So lots to read and watch, as well as new podcasts that have been recommended to us. Look, thank you for your company this week. And thank you, Hamish. We've had a lot of feedback, in fact, on AI. A bit surprising in a sense and very thoughtful. So that was most rewarding, I think.
We'll get to some more feedback in the coming weeks. If you do want to get in touch with us, the address is global.roaming@abc.net.au. You can find the email address in the show notes as well. And just a reminder, we're doing our first Global Roaming Live at the Sydney Writers' Festival. That'll be on Saturday, the 25th of May. The theme will be Australia's Twin Perils. So again, we'll be talking about China and the United States. We'd really love to meet you in person.
The two Leviathans. Okay, thanks, Hamish. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.